Morning, everybody. And thanks very much, Alan, for the introduction. And I want to thank the organizers of the special session today for including me. I'm a little bit different from the other presentations, and my goal and my role this morning is to provide a little bit of a federal context to this discussion of all of the projects and activities going on in the Gulf. Basically, we've had within the public health world, we've had over a decade of very robust programmatic activity on preparedness. All hazards preparedness was kind of driven by bioterrorism, but there's been a lot of extreme weather preparedness, which hasn't really included climate change very much. In the last few years, we've had a lot of programming in the federal government on sustainability. And when I say sustainability, I'm talking about kind of environmental sustainability, about modifying the use of our resources in a way that we preserve resources for future generations, that kind of sustainability. We've had a lot of sustainability measures within the federal government, but that hasn't really included health very much, and it hasn't been closely tied to climate adaptation and improving resilience in communities and in the healthcare sector. So what I'm going to be talking about is this intersection of new efforts that are going on related to climate resilience and climate adaptation that within the health sector we're trying to do in an integrated fashion with all the sustainability efforts and in a way that promotes community resilience and health resilience across the whole spectrum of the health sector, ranging from individuals who have medical care needs at their homes all the way up to tertiary hospitals and biomedical research labs. So that's what I'm going to try to do in 15 minutes. I have no financial conflicts to disclose. And I thought I'd start just by invoking the example of Sandy. And we've had wonderful presentations on Sandy. I'm not going to go into detail about what happened there, only to say that, to me, Sandy illustrates a couple of things, both the problem we still have and the opportunity we still have. Clearly, there was a gap between preparedness here and the ability to protect people, communities, to a large extent, health, in the event of a pretty extreme event. It also starts raising the question of, okay, if we have a dynamic situation of climate change, rising sea level, perhaps more intense hurricanes, how do we adjust this preparedness paradigm that we have, which is very much historical data-based, in order to assure that we have measures in place to protect us against this? And then at the same time, Sandy provides a really great example of people starting to think about sustainability, energy consumption, water resource consumption, and the resilience and climate adaptation of infrastructure and facilities at the same time. The groups that are working on Sandy get this. They're doing this. This is not, there's a federal component to this, but there's a lot of local components to this as well. So I'm not going to talk in any more detail about Sandy. We've heard about that, but this is the kind of thing that we're trying to facilitate through the policy structures within the federal government. And we've heard a lot about this already. One of the other things to take away from Sandy is that it affected the dialysis facilities, the nursing homes, obviously the major medical facilities that we heard about in the news. And there's also a tremendous hit taken by the biomedical research facilities. $100,000 in value in animals is probably millions and millions of dollars of pain and suffering among the researchers, and untold and very unquantifiable impacts on the research itself. So this is what I'm going to try to cover. I know that I said I was going to do case studies, and I put this abstract in about 11 months ago, as we all know. And in those ensuing 11 months, the policy arena has really heated up, if you will, on climate change adaptation within the federal government. So I'm going to be giving a little bit more of an update on the policy framework that's developed in the last 11 months while still trying to tell you a little bit about some of the case studies. So the start of all this is an executive order that was passed by the Obama administration in October 2009 called Federal Leadership in Environmental, Energy, and Economic Performance. And this was a sustainability and climate resilience executive order, very much weighted to the sustainability side. It had a lot of detail on very specific targets for federal agencies to cut energy consumption, change their fleet mileage, do all kinds of things to reduce energy use and reduce waste. Very clearly spelled out, a lot of reporting for it. And then it said, oh, and by the way, all you agencies need to figure out your vulnerabilities for climate change and come up with a plan. And we'll tell you how to do it next year. That was basically Executive Order 13514. It created an interagency climate adaptation task force. which produced a report back in 2010, and it set in motion this idea that the agencies need to think about these things in tandem, but also start thinking about climate change impacts and adaptation. This was a statement that Secretary Sebelius put out in response to this, and I put it up just to show you that right from the start, Secretary Sebelius got that this is about integrating climate change, adaptation, and mitigation strategies together. Don't have time to talk about it more. Just last Friday, there is a new executive order that came out. It didn't get a whole lot of press, so many of you may not know about this. I couldn't even figure out what the number of it was. I haven't seen the number. But this is kind of a follow-on to Executive Order 13514, which mostly just says, rah-rah, more of the same in many ways. It says we're going to continue to work on sustainability, but at the same time, we really want you agencies to look at your plans, update your climate adaptation plans, make them more robust. It sets in place a couple of other things, a multi-sectoral council of tribal leaders and industry and local governments, and it also reestablishes a federal high-level adaptation task force. It's called a council now, with high-level representation to move forward and coordinate on adaptation planning. And my next slide just kind of says all of that. There's also sections about robust ecosystem management, managing lands and waters for climate resilience, and there's a section there about science, data, information, and decision support tools. So we've talked about this need to integrate sustainability and climate resilience. I just wanted to put two different perspectives on and give it a little more detail on why this is important. From the engineering perspective, it's really important because there are important synergies that can be identified, especially in terms of, you know, retrofitting, renovating, and especially in terms of new design, to think about these two things together, that opportunities emerge. For example, cooling, if you're going to make a building more insulated and more heat efficient, you reduce the size of the air conditioning needed when you build it, and you save money in that way. And all of that is about both sustainability and climate resilience. At the same time, things can also counteract, and you need to identify the problems you're going to run into in terms of resilience as you're trying to, if you're trying to go lean and mean on sustainability, that can sometimes make you less resilient in a stressful situation. So if you don't take that into account, you may be increasing your vulnerability. From a public health perspective, it's also very important. A lot of the benefits that we get from dealing with climate change are co-benefits in the near term from reducing energy use, from reducing fossil fuel combustion, from providing workforces and people and communities with alternative means of transportation that make them more physically active. So there's a kind of urban planning level synergy between climate resilience and sustainability. There's also a facility level public health benefit. Some of those public health benefits are kind of, the power plant that serves that hospital may be 40 miles away. It may be a kind of diffuse benefit. Some of them may be more local in terms of numerous backup diesel generators and what's the community exposure to those if they go on. So I don't have time to go into detail on this, but just it's really important as we think about these efforts, both at the community and the facility level, to be thinking about them in an integrated way. So this is part of what Health and Human Services has put forward in its planning in terms of an approach to climate change adaptation. It's science-driven, it's data-driven. A lot of what we need to do in the health sector is to increase awareness among our colleagues. There are people who have been working on this, see this as part of their day in and day out, but as you all know, people who are working and focusing on healthcare for the elderly, people who are working on children's health issues, people who are working on disaster preparedness, believe it or not, sometimes don't see climate change as part of their work. They think of it as something, someone's going to worry about that because it's going to happen 50 years from now, but we all know climate change is happening now, and so there's a big awareness-raising piece of this as well. A lot of work on partnership, and the flip side of awareness-raising is that this is not the creation of a whole new set of programs. As we think about this from a management and a governance level, it's really about bringing the right information into existing programs that are already in this space and doing this kind of work and just ensuring they're taking the right information into account in their planning, in their long-term planning especially, and making the right decisions. So these are some of the highlights from the very first high-level vulnerability assessment that the Department of Health and Human Services did in response to Executive Order 13514. A lot of it had to do with looking at the program and the mission of specific elements of HHS, because a lot of what HHS does is protect vulnerable populations. And so there's a lot of vulnerable populations that have additional climate stressors. That's about all I can say because of time. And in terms of key actions in the current Strategic Sustainability Performance Plan, which is our reporting on Executive 13514, we're working on a partnership with the healthcare industry. We have educational and workshop activities going on both externally and internally. We are continuing to look at the high-level vulnerability for parts of HHS. And another piece of what's going on within HHS is trying to elevate the importance of these measures in the accountability of senior staff and really get the senior level management on board and incorporating this into their daily life and their decision making. So one of the case studies, one of the pilots that we're doing is what we're doing at NIH. NIH is kind of a microcosm of the health sector. We've got a lot of biomedical research facilities. We've got a big hospital. We've got satellite facilities. We're not very geographically diverse, but we have a little geographical diversity. And so we have several teams coming together at NIH to look at the existing sustainability plan, to look at the existing continuity of operations plan. That's that COOP, C-O-O-P. And to reassess them from a context of climate change. Again, in Bethesda, we don't worry about sea level rise, but we did take a hit from the derecho that came through and knocked out power all around, killed people in the Bethesda area. And then we're also looking at trying to work climate resilience into what NIH does the most, which is fund our academic biomedical research facilities and trying to ensure that those biomedical research facilities as part of their preparedness, already a part of what we do, but ensuring that that's robust enough to try to avoid the kinds of things we've seen in Houston and New Orleans and in New York City. And then lastly, we have our research portfolio to try to provide the scientific basis for health adaptation broadly for all populations and also looking at specific kind of questions of population vulnerability. So we were cooking along on Executive Order 13514 for a couple of years, and then most of you know that in May and June, towards the end of June, the President announced a kind of focused and emphatic climate action plan. And health is well represented in this climate action plan, given that, you know, there's so much to do about climate change from the mitigation standpoint, but Climate Action Plan has a mitigation piece, an adaptation piece, and an international leadership piece. And health is well represented within that adaptation part. There are two very clear parts related to health in there. One is an effort on sustainable and climate resilient. It says hospitals. We think of that as more broadly as healthcare facilities across the spectrum, as well as a community resilience piece, community health resilience, which is primarily the activities at the CDC under its Climate Ready Cities and States initiative, and we've had presentations on this at APHA. I won't say more about that. There's some stealth places where health is in there as well. We have a special interim assessment report that we're developing that's mentioned just by the word health somewhere, that's going to be providing a more robust technical update to the National Climate Assessment for the health sector and providing some quantitative projections of health impacts of climate change, where we can do that at a national scale for the first time. We have a new web portal for data that are relevant to health and climate change called the Metadata Access Tool for Climate and Health, or MATCH. And that's a big part of where the federal government is looking, or it's a component of the information and toolkit side that the federal government is launching as well. Okay. This is just summarizing what we've already mentioned. Under the sustainable and resilient healthcare facilities, we had to come up with things that we could do on in a short time frame on a modest budget. So what we are providing is a set of informational tools developed by some of the experts in the field with stakeholder input. We'll be vetting these through a public-private partnership that we are incorporating and merging with existing public-private partnerships on preparedness. And then we're also going to be working within the federal government among those agencies that manage healthcare facilities to share best practices and ensure that, those healthcare facilities are using the state-of-the-art planning tools. Very quickly, here are a couple of examples of how this gets operationalized. One of the best examples is right here in Boston. In fact, the architect who designed the Spalding Rehab Hospital is the person who's working with us on our toolkit. This is a brand new facility. It built down on the harbor. It has to worry about sea level rise, and so there's a lot of landscaping that's been done to address issues of sea level rise and storm surge. At the same time, it has drought-resistant landscaping, which is a sustainability measure to preserve water. It has operable windows so that if the power goes out, you don't have to evacuate the hospital, under most times. And rather than putting electrical and backup systems in the basement, like we've seen so many times fail, they've been placed on the roof. This is another example of a resilient facility. This is the Mercy Hospital in Joplin, which is being rebuilt at the site of, as you know, the hospital that was devastated there several years ago. And they've basically found a way to make windows resistant to 2x4s coming at them at a speed of 150 miles an hour. I've seen some of these videos of the testing of these windows. It's quite incredible. So they've designed this facility to withstand another F5 hurricane like they had before. There's issues here related to really hardening versus resilience and flexibility. There's different examples. Anybody's interested, I could try to talk about that during a Q&A. So in conclusion, what we're going to be talking about now for the rest of the session is about ways to reduce health sector vulnerability. There's a facilities vulnerability. There's also obviously a population vulnerability, and that will be the focus, I think, of the rest of the talks. I hope I've let you see how health is incorporated into these federal areas of climate change. This is a relatively new development. There's a lot of interest. There's a lot of momentum gaining. We're still in early phases. And we look forward to partnerships on this integration of sustainability and climate resilience, bringing in local state governments, private sector, tribal governments, and working together to improve this. So with that, I'll stop and thank you very much.